Right, so please give a warm Valley Group welcome to Chris.
Hi, I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic. You know, Bill said to me and a couple of other people, they said, man, you got a really good turnout tonight. And I could now sit down because that's the whole story, okay? I mean, I have people here from my home group, the Sunday Serenity Seekers AA group. I have folks that have sponsored me and who are in my sponsorship family here. I have people that I'm sponsoring. I have just dozens of friends that have shown up tonight from the Bridge Street Drunks, from Pine, from the ladies, and it's so wonderful to see everybody. But I can't say that that's the way I came in here, because I came in here only with surfacey business bullshit relationships, acquaintances, and a number of dear friends who I had badly abused and driven far, far away. But that happened way down the line. I'm very fortunate, I think, because, and I used to not think so. I used to think that I used to have a lot of sour grapes in my life and resentments about the fact that that I was a retread a few times. Now I see that as an absolute blessing. I first got into recovery when I was 17 years old, and that was 1968. And I was made a ward of the state of California and taken away from my parents. And I was given the option because of my, I will say, drug use. It wasn't alcoholism at the time, but it was drug use and criminality. And I was taken away from them. And I was given an option of either going to YA, which is kiddie prison, Byron's Boys Camp, which is kiddie prison outside, or I could go to a drug treatment program, which was one of the grandfathers of the drug treatment milieu. You know, Pine and all the stuff that came after that was kind of fashioned on what they had done. And I knew that there were no locks on the doors. I knew there were girls there. And I figured, well, I'll take the program, you know. I went into that place. I don't want to, like, get off on into the weeds about other substances and stuff, but the reality was that although I was raised in and around alcohol, and I had drunk a few times in my life. As a matter of fact, the first time I drank, I was about 11 years old, and I had a blackout. I should have realized that was, you know, presaging things to come. But I had a love affair with alcohol from the time I was very young. Probably around the same period of time, I had pretty much memorized Mr. Boston's Bartender's Guide. And, you know, my parents were from the era of the cocktail party, and their idea was to all their friends get together, shove the kids in the back room while they all got drunk. And so, you know, that's kind of what I was raised around. I thought, you know, guys like Lee Marvin that could, you know, hard-boiled, privatized, you know, in the movies that could hold their liquor, or John Wayne who'd swagger into a bar and, you know, slam down a shot. I mean, those were my heroes when I was little, and that's the way I was raised. And I thought that's what men did. The reality was, though, that when I got into my teenage years, I left alcohol behind. My dad, though, made it in the basement. He was a brewmaster before his time, and he used to brew home-brewed beer, which was very heavy, high alcohol content in the basement. I should have realized there was something wrong with me when I would steal the beer and not drink it. I would trade it away to make friends, which tells you something a little bit about my character, okay? I went off in another direction. I can remember my friends and I had heard once that the bush called Scotch Broom, which has a nice pretty yellow leaf, had a mild psychedelic content, and we stripped the neighborhood of all the leaves and made salad and ate it, you know, because we just had to get high, you know. And that's kind of the way my life went up into my teenage years. And when I was 17, though, you know, my drug use, my LSD, speed, anything I could get my hands on led me trapped into recovery. And it was not a 12-step program. It was based on spiritual principles, however. I got up every morning and we said a prayer that's very similar to the prayer that a lot of AAs know, that's in our 12 and 12, with a prayer of St. Francis. And it was a variation on that. Said it every morning. We believed in spiritual principles. And there was no alcohol, no drugs, no nothing. And I loved it. I stayed there on probation for 2 years. For those of you that think a 28-day stint is tough, I was on probation for 2 years there. But I was having so much fun by the time I finished that I decided to stay on. And I became part of the staff, and it became part of my life. And I lived that way, having great adventures and great fun, clean and sober, and living among this great fellowship of people that were dear friends of mine for about 10 years before I was introduced to alcohol again. And at that time, the founder of the organization said, well, you know what? You can learn to drink like a gentleman. The passage of time it makes a difference. And you can drink like a gentleman. To be honest with you, though, I couldn't wait. I mean, I really couldn't wait. I think I was probably so dry that if you got me, near a match, I would have just gone up in flames. So what I did was all of us gave up our recovery at that point. And it was really interesting because I was never taught about the medical aspect of this disease. I was not taught about the allergy to alcohol. And you know what? One of the hardest things for me to come to terms with later on in life was that some of those dear friends that I had come into the organization with, who were little teenage drug addicts like me, went on to be able to drink like gentlemen. And I was an alcoholic. And, oh man, did I grind my teeth over that. And it wasn't until recently that I began to come to terms with the fact that was all right. I used to drink over that. But the reality is that I should have realized there was a problem on that first time I drank. Golden Cadillacs, right? Made with Galliano. And I was in a blackout, rolling around the floor with somebody else's wife that night. I mean, when I came to, it's not good when you're in a blackout and you come out on the floor and your wife is throwing shit around the room, okay? But I suppose that could have happened to anybody their first time drinking, I told myself that anyway. And the reality is, though, the next morning, I got up and I hit it again. And I went right back. And I could not get enough. And I became the guy very quickly that in this organization that had gone back to promoting alcohol put on what they called the sober squad because I was always out of control. But for me, I know I've heard so many stories, and I was not the way it was for me is I didn't know which time I was going to be out of control. So for me, drinking became like playing Russian roulette. And there were times when I could sit down at a dinner and have a nice, couple of glasses of wine at dinner and then go on and do that the next day and the next day. And then, with no ability to predict which time it was going to be, I would be off and running and in a blackout and dancing on the tables and, I was happy drunk. At least I was happy. Everybody else around me, I guess, was miserable. But, so that's the way it was for me. And, it became important for me to know that later on because for a long time I thought that meant I wasn't an alcoholic. Because you hear about being powerless over alcohol. And I thought that meant powerless all the time. But I came to understand that if I couldn't predict which time I was going to be out of control, that meant that I had lost the control over the ability to drink. And those times became more and more frequent. I also would be remiss if I didn't tell you that at the time I started drinking, and I've come to this relatively recently, You got to realize I was 27 years old, so fairly late when I came in. And I had been raised in my own family with pretty strong principles. I was not a religious family, but good, strong moral values, okay? And those were in me. And then I came into an organization which really pounded them into me for years. And then I started to betray my principles. And as the organization started to go sideways and move away from its core of working with people who were in trouble with drugs and alcohol and juvenile delinquency and crime, I began to be forced into a position to decide whether I was going to go along with the crowd or whether I was going to betray my own spiritual principles, my own values that I was taught. And I betrayed those. And by the time I drank, I was so miserable and conflicted and so ready for a drink. So, you know, even back then, at the age of 27, I had already been, I was charged with crimes. I was being hunted by the law. I had gotten into the law by that point. I was a private investigator for the legal department of this organization, and I had become the senior investigator there with many people working for me, and I had become a target for the authorities. And so I had all these things now mounting up on me that I began to feel so sorry for myself about, and so pushed around by the man, and, you know, all these justifications as to why, you know, it was going to be, you know, that why I could have these resentments about life and how things were going and things, you know, and when I drank, it was like all that stuff was, you know, went away when I drank. And I felt great for the first time in a few years since I had started betraying my own values. And it wasn't too long after I began to drink that I began to try all those other remedies that we talk about in the third in chapter 3. One day I had a complete meltdown, a raging fit. I was sober at the time. But it went from like absolute blind, insane rage to tears that would never stop, and they bundled me up and sent me to the shrink. And so I began to get, you know, psychiatry involved. They put me on antidepressants. But you know what? All throughout that, and they said, oh, it's recommended that you don't drink. Well, yeah, recommendation. And you know, I would do anything to weasel my way off that sober squad and back to drinking. That's the last time I'm doing tequila, you know, or I'm sticking with the beer. But, you know, somehow the beer always turned into a depth charge, so I tried all that, you know. And so it went from psychiatry. You know, I didn't think the antidepressants were working. Of course, I was drinking myself stupid at the time as well. So, you know, I went on to something else. But at some point, the organization completely fell apart. And I found myself at the age of about 40 years old. Now, remember, I went into this place at 17. Spit out and found myself an attorney. I'd gone to law school at that point, actually, and I had we had put together a law school. A bunch of us had become lawyers, and I found myself washed up here in Visalia, and practicing law, and I was completely adrift. I was like, you know, the first day I remember, I got up, I went out. I had a law practice. We were in the, you know, the big blue building, like on Murray near the liquor store. I know you can orient anything in town according to where the liquor store is, right? You know, so a block east of that. I can remember looking outside and seeing the crows and saying to myself, death. You know, it's found me in Visalia. I mean, I was so depressed, it was horrible. And you know what? It was shortly after that, you know, through circumstances, at probably the age of 42, I wound up picking up drugs. And after having been clean from drugs and only drinking, you know, at about the age of 42, I picked up a crack pipe. Now, you know, when the guy gets to the part of the story about crack, it's almost over. About 6 months later, I was a raving lunatic, and I actually tried that too, you know, where okay, boy, I got to stop this. But of course, I went right back to the alcohol, and I was out of control on the alcohol, and then it was back to the crack, and then I was on that merry-go-round for a while. But I was so fortunate because at some point, I reached out to my wife and the senior partner of my law firm, and I said, "Help, help! I mean, I can't do this. I'm going insane." And I was very, very fortunate because at that point in time, I found out that some of those people that I thought I had driven so far away from me were there for me. And they helped me get into some outpatient place up in Clovis. And it was really just a boot camp for the 12 steps. And thank God for that. And this old guy took me under his wing named Barry. He passed away last year with over 35 years. In sobriety. But he was a great guy. And thank God for him, because all my friends were really concerned about those drugs. Now, my wife, she was a little more concerned about the alcohol, since it gotten to the point when I was a daily drinker. I usually didn't drink during the day unless there was some plausible excuse like a luncheon or something to get away with it. But I would, you know, the minute I would hit the house at night, I would start drinking, and I would make myself a triple martini, and then I'd have something while I was cooking, and then we'd have wine with dinner, and then we'd have after dinner drinks, and then I'd have something to help me go to sleep, and then I started getting up because my sleep was disrupted because my alcohol was burning off and I'd have to get some more. And that's kind of the way it was at the end. So she was much more concerned. But most of the people around me were concerned about that cocaine. Well, thank God for Barry, because he made me stop in my first step and look back at my behavior with alcohol and how alcohol had played such a role in destroying my life, and how I had lost so much behind that. And I thank him for that to this day. And you know, I got into recovery at that point. And for a couple of years probably, I was very, very active. Although I must tell you, being an attorney at the time and living in Visalia, I was so scared that I think I didn't make a meeting in Visalia for about 6 months. And I was making a meeting every day. I was going to Clovis, I was going to Selma, I was going to Hanford, anywhere but Visalia. Of course, when finally somebody, you know, my sponsor, I think, you know, he said, "Hey, you think you ought to make a meeting in Visalia?" You know, I went in and I knew like a bunch of the people in the room, and you know, I don't know what the big deal was, but that's how it is for us sometime, you know. And the thing that was great, though, was, you know, I finally did settle down into a home group, and it was the Sunday Morning Serenity Seekers back in probably 1993, 1994, I began being there. And I got involved in service at the group level and began to, you know, I secretaried for a while. I did the treasurer thing. But I'll tell you something. I worked all the way through the steps the first time. Well, at least through 9, and then I figured, well, 10, 11, 12 is just kind of like, okay, I'll practice these principles on all my affairs and everything will be fine. I'll just be a good guy. But, you know, the thing was, the truth was that very quickly I was slipping away from the program. I did not, I had a sponsee for a little while in maybe 1994, and he kind of slipped away. Never worked with anybody else. I never did any service work by going to the jail or going to programs. I just went to my meeting once a week, and that was it. And I did that, though, and it kept me, you know, clean and sober for many, many years. But at some point, that once a week became fewer and fewer. The calls to the sponsor became less and less. I began to see my sponsor about once a year when we go on a fishing trip to Monterey. And never got a local sponsor. And pretty soon I just wasn't going to any recovery stuff at all. And the thing that's crazy is, of course, what I didn't realize at the time was I was taking my life back over. I had no, I mean, any meager conception of a power greater than myself that I had been working on for those first couple of years had completely gone out the door. And I'll tell you why. Because early on, I said, okay, the group is going to be my higher power. I can get my mind around that. And that was great. Because you know what? The reality is, to this day, I hear God speaking to me through through the group. And our second tradition tells us that, God speaks through our group conscience, right? And that happens when we're in a meeting. And so that happened. But you know what? You go away from meetings, no God. Okay? And I thought I was okay. I was an attorney. I was a big shot. You know, I thought I was successful. But the reality was that I had begun, just like back in the 90s when I started using drugs, I started keeping secrets. And I had no one to share them with. I had no outlet to go to. And it didn't have to do with using drugs. I mean, everybody knows, if you've been around recovery for a while, people get funny over money, sex, and God knows what the other thing is, but but those two are pretty heavy right there. But so I had slipped away. And that living that secret life just became, you know, it became worse and worse. But my disease is one of delusion. And you know, I used to think, if I go crazy, I'll know it. But that's not, isn't that right? But that's not true. That's not the way it works. It doesn't work that way. I go crazy and I can't tell because I'm crazy. You laugh, but that, because you know, it's true, right? That's what began to happen to me. And I became more and more corrupt and more alone. And I was living this life where nobody knew that I was living this way. I was just living this whole secret existence. And at some point, like about 14 years into, like, I was clean. I wasn't clean. I was abstinent. Well, let me back up. It actually, not so abstinent, because at some point, you know, the old duels came out. And it was like, well, it doesn't get you high anyway. The prescription medicine for that oral surgery came, and it's, two or three every 3 or 4 hours, that's, you know, two every 3 hours. Nobody wants to see that shit go to waste, you know, so you can't let that go. So you chisel a little bit, but you don't, I mean, this is part of being delusional, right? I mean, you don't know that you're crazy, right? Because nobody's there to, you know, to reflect myself back to me like I have today, because I surround myself with other addicts and alcoholics who can show me myself. And so it went like that for about 14 years. And then one day I was somewhere and the crack pipe came out, and it was in my mouth and in my lungs before I could even think about anything else. It just actually, it seemed like a good idea. And, you know, if you ever tell yourself, well, I can always come back. I can always just pull out of the nosedive. You know what they say about pilots, right? If you're in a spin, if you do what instinctually seems correct, you will not pull out of the spin. You will actually put yourself deeper into the dive. I mean, that's kind of the way it is. If you're insane, you're insane, right? So for another 2 years, I went on a run with drugs. And I'm going to tell you, the reason I tell you that is because I understand what it's like to be an alcoholic and think, I used to tell myself, at least I haven't drunk. At least I haven't drunk. I used to say that. And I would assiduously stay away from alcohol while I was using meth or all these other drugs. And then finally one day, I didn't have anything else. And there was that bottle. Because I always kept liquor around the house. Because I know what it says, and you know about how the old timers used to keep booze in the house to help people. And I'm down with that. I mean, you know, if it's been removed, that's great. And if you're using it for that purpose, but I was not spiritually fit. And out came the booze, and I started hitting that again. And it was right there for me, and just like an old friend, you know. But thank God. And you know, the thing about not pulling out. being able to, you know, come back. It never once occurred to me, just get your ass to a meeting. Or just stop doing the crazy shit that's making you feel like shit. And thank God I got jammed up and I got found out. Because, you know, my wife found some of my paraphernalia and I realized I'm jammed up. And at that point, thank God I had a moment of clarity that said, you know, get yourself to a meeting. And I did, over at the Alano Club. I was high at the time. And afterwards, I went and I got high again. Because I still had some. And that's the way it works for us. But God was looking after me. And I was okay. Because, you know, because I did get myself to another meeting. And I met some really great people that snatched me up and introduced me to some other men in recovery. And you know, I started just making meetings at that time, and that was 21 months ago. So I have 21 months back, and I'm so grateful for the fact that I have those 21 months today. And to me, the way they feel today is that they're worth more than all the 14 years that I spent previously. And I'm going to tell you why. I realized. Mainly, I'll tell you, very early on, I realized, I felt this need that I had to get back to the Serenity Seekers, because I knew that there were people that were still going there that had known me, and I felt dirty, like, and I needed to go and at least, you know, confess myself to my friends and my peers and stuff, and I was met with loving, open arms. By people that had known me, people that I had been an old timer to, and it was a wonderful feeling, and it made it okay for me to come back. Never in a million years did I think I was going to be embraced with love coming back, because I had dumped so much shame and stuff on myself. And because of that, I was able to then reach out to Barry. Up in Clovis, and I was able to talk to him before he died, and he treated me the exact same way, with love and caring, and gave me some good, solid direction. But you know, just because I came back didn't mean I was anywhere near sane. You know, I didn't want a sponsor. I figured, well, I know this shit, you know. I used to drive around month after month listening to the Big Book on tape over and over and over again. I don't need a sponsor. But you know, finally, the information began to sink in as I began to clear up. And, you know, I now have a sponsor today who has a sponsor, who has a sponsor, who has a sponsor, who has a sponsor. And we all know each other. And we all have something to do with each other. And I tell you that today because one of the things that you got to remember is the steps begin with the word we. We. My disease is one of alienation and being alone, right? And thinking I can do it by myself. And all my best thinking tells me that I'm not like you. You know, this one, you know, Alan. Okay, so Alan's not like me, okay? But that's a whole other deal. No. Because there's always reasons, right? There's the biker dude. There's the old one. There's the young one. That guy slammed smack. And this one, oh, he was a down and out, you know, wino or, you know, whatever the hell it is. All that is the way my thinking works. And it's to separate me from the pack and to keep me from you. Because we is the solution. And so long as I keep carving myself away and staying away from meetings and not call my sponsor and not keep in touch with the guys who I'm working with and, you know, don't, you know, go to the jail or don't go to Pine and have an H&I meeting or whatever it is, those things will drive me back to my best thinking. And, you know, I despair sometimes for people when I think, you know, a lot of people look and they say, man, if I only had the car and the job and the girl and the house and the money, I'd be just fine. Well, let me tell you something. Because, you know, I've been married 25 years. you know, I have the house, I have a car, I have a job, and I was one sick mother, and I was ready to blow my brains out. And the thing that brings me peace today is working these steps and working with others. The thing that was said at the very beginning of this meeting, working with another alcoholic is the thing that saves my ass every day. And so today, and for the last 21 months, or probably not from the very beginning, but actually fairly early on, I started to try to turn my life over to a power greater than myself and develop that now for the first time. And not just make it the group, although the group is just fine if that's what's going to work for you. But I began to make much less heavy lifting of the God thing, okay? I know that I've been saved because of a power greater than myself, and my job is to develop a strong, firm connection with that power. And to the degree I can get the crap of the past out of the way and the fears of the future off the table by doing these steps, I'm going to have that connection. And I can keep it if I work with others and keep reminding myself that I ain't nothing. I'm just an alcoholic. I'm just an alcoholic. Everybody else in this room, I only happen to have been graced like all of us with my own walk and my own story, which I'm here to tell you today, because it's a story that I hope you walk away from here saying there is a solution. There is hope. And that we can be made whole again through these steps. And with that, I thank you very much for allowing me to speak.